On assassinations and a revealing look at the history of assassination, Lord Kenneth Baker examines over 100 political and religious murders or attempted murders, ranging from Julius Caesar to President Kennedy to Osama bin Laden. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK. Lord Baker himself, good morning, Lord Baker.
Good morning to you.
Good to have you.
It's almost hot as Spain is today, I can tell you. We've got a heat wave in London, in Sussex.
Ah, marvellous. Well, at least you're hopefully you're keeping sort of keeping cool, as it were, and reading a good book.
Yeah.
tell me a little bit then about this is, if you like, an interesting book because you yourself, of course, were almost the victim of a huge assassination attempt in the early 80s.
Yes, I was. I've written it because I've known eight people who've been assassinated. Four of them were MPs, and two were close personal friends. Tony Benny was killed in a bomb at Brighton, and Ian Gough, who was Margaret Thatcher's private personal secretary, the best she ever had, he was blown up in his car outside his house in Sussex. And the Brighton bomb, I was very lucky. I had to leave Brighton at about 2 o'clock in the morning because I had to go back to London for a debate with Ken Livingstone. I was the environment minister and we were abolishing the GLC in those days. And the last person I talked to as I walked down from the steps of the hotel, it was Tony Berry walking back up, having exercised his dog on the promenade. And we talked about the conference, how well it was going, all that sort. But 3 hours later, he was dead. He was a very close personal friend. He was my bridge partner, amongst other things. So I wrote this book, really, to see whether assassinations have really changed the history of the world. And the conclusion I came to is that they barely have affected it at all. They might have given it an occasional glancing blow. The one assassination that did change history of the world was the murder of Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo in 1914. And it was most unlikely that was going to change history of the world. That was going to be another Balkan war between Bosnia and Serbia. But it turned into the First World War. And so I studied that in great care. And one of the things I discovered was that he died almost by accident. He wanted to visit Sarajevo because he was the heir to the Austrian Empire and he wanted to show how strong the Austrian army was. He did some attended military maneuvers. Then he stayed on to visit Sarajevo. But there was a group of young Bosnian nationalists who determined to kill him. There were seven of them. And all six failed. But one, purely by chance, shot him. Because when he was returning to go back to the station, the car took a wrong turning and turned up right, and it just happened to be where the assassin was standing. And he just pulled out his revolver and shot. He didn't actually aim, he just shot vaguely towards the carriage. And the first shot went through the side of the carriage into the spleen and stomach of the Archduchess. And the second was a recoil. He didn't aim it. He just fired it again, and it went through the neck of the of Franz Ferdinand. And it was pure luck, actually. Most extraordinary, wasn't it?
I mean, isn't that
that led to the First World War.
Isn't it one of the things, though, that you know, in the tragic history of assassinations, there are what-ifs. So, for example, if Martin Luther King hadn't stepped outside for a cigarette on that balcony...
Right.
He would
sure
have...
Sure chance.
Yeah.
He stepped outside to smoke a cigarette, and it so happened his assassin, who was a madman, had trained his rifle upon the balcony because he thought there was sometime he'd have a chance, and he was shot. That was really very, very bad luck indeed, obviously. But, you know, the day of the individual assassin, like the one who shot Martin Luther King or the one who shot Franz Ferdinand, has largely been superseded today by states actually assassinating people. And you saw this with Russia. Russia has assassinated people. They had a Gert Skripal with a poisoning at Salisbury using Novichok. They actually did kill another dissident journalist, Litvinenko, with polonium in his tea, put in his tea in a hotel in London. And then there was the famous one of Markov, who was poisoned by a poisoned tip of an umbrella. But this is all Russia taking revenge on people who they feel have betrayed it. And the Putin uses assassination to remain in power. His greatest opponent was a Russian politician called Nemtsov, who had once been the deputy prime minister. and he and his fiance were shot on the Kremlin Bridge. And Putin uses murder. Israel also uses murder. Mossad has probably been responsible for the death of 500 people by assassination. And not only in Israel, the head of Fatah, the Arab military operation, was a man called Abu Jihad, very, very talented fighter. And he lived in Tunisia, and so they planned to kill him in Tunisia, some nearly 1,500 miles away. And that was a very elaborate operation with helicopters and hospital ship and everything. And only last year, Israel shot a professor of engineering in Malaysia, Adi Albata, who was in fact working on a much more dangerous bomb for the Israelis. So you're getting states doing it.
Yeah.
And in fact, earlier this year, President Trump ordered the assassination of Qassem Soleimani, who was the leading Iranian general. It had been proposed to two other presidents that he should be assassinated. They turned it down, but he said, no, go ahead. And he took out the leading Iranian figure in the whole of the Middle East. But that didn't lead to anything. Iran said that they would punish America, but they have not done anything like that. On the whole, assassinations achieve very little, hardly anything at all. The interesting one, some of the misses are important. Hitler, on November the 9th, 1939, went back to Munich to celebrate the birth of the Nazi movement. He always did it on that day, every year, to meet his old cronies. It was the first day of the war, of the Second World War. And he always left at 9:30, very sharply. And there was an assassin who wasn't pretty motivated at all. He just decided that Hitler was a bad guy, was going to go to war, and that would be very bad for Germany. And by himself, he decided to try and assassinate Hitler. And he knew he was going to this beer cellar. So he went to it, and he saw the platform on which Hitler would be speaking, and there was a wooden pillar behind it. And so he patiently went several times to the beer cellar and hollowed out a little hollowed space in the pillar. And he put into it a bomb that was timed to go off before 9:30, just before 9:30. But unfortunately for him, Hitler decided to leave urgently at 9:13, 17 minutes earlier. Now, if Hitler had stayed on to the end, he would certainly have been killed, because when the bomb went off, 8 people were killed. And that would have changed the history of the world. We wouldn't have had the Second World War. We wouldn't have had the Holocaust and all the rest of it.
You said that...
So that was an omission that changed the history of the world.
Mm. You said that... the assassinations don't really work, if you like. But when you have sort of the Americans assassinating Bin Laden, if you like, although you can argue that's a different sort of assassination, or the attack earlier this year, or you have Russia taking out Putin's adversaries, or as you said, Mossad taking out people around the world, surely that sends a signal to others who might think of doing your state harm.
Well, it might be, but it doesn't seem to work like that, because there are lots of people still plotting against Israel. Israel is having to fight for its survival, opposed by all the Arab world, obviously. And so they look upon it as a matter of self-defense. Putin looks at it as a means of keeping it in power. And after the Skripal exhibition failure, he had to go at somebody else in another part of the world. The details of that have just leaked out. And he is quite prepared to use assassination methods whenever it's necessary for him to obtain power. But also, the weapons have changed now. It used to be a pistol or a knife or poison. Now drones are used. A drone was used to kill Qassem Soleimani by Trump. But we have also, Britain have used drones. Britain took out Johnny Jihadi. He was the man who cut the throat of the aid worker Helling. And a drone was directed to him. America said they were going to do it. Did they have the British approval? And Britain said certainly yes. And the British drone was approved by David Cameron as Prime Minister to kill Mohammed Awazi, who was an ISIL fighter who went left Cardiff, actually, and started to recruit Brits to fight in the Great Caliphate Wars. And actually, he was starting to plan attacks in Britain. And so Cameron agreed that the Doan should take him out one night. So states use now that sort of method, actually, as matters of self-defence.
And did you find, if you like, a common thread? Because there's a whole... I mean, we go from Julius Caesar, and you know, Shakespeare speaks about murder in the Scottish play as well. But do you find a common thread running through? Is it predominantly an individual, however unhinged and deranged they may be, with a supposed grudge that tends to be the gunman, the knife man, the assassin?
Yes, there are very often personal grudges. we only had one prime minister assassinated in British history, by called Spencer Percival in 1812, and he was assassinated by a man who had a grudge that he lost a lot of money in Russia, and Britain wasn't prepared to help him get it back. And he got so annoyed he just went into the House of Commons one day, and as the prime minister came through the door, he shot him. And similarly, Charles I's favourite minister, Buckingham, was also assassinated in 1628 by an officer who had been promoted. So you still get those personal grudges, as it were, but they're very, very rare. And the day of the person assassination, the person doing it, is not completely over, but is no longer the characteristic. The assassinations today are carefully planned operations. By the security forces of certain states, when they decide to take out a particular person.
And when it comes to, if you like, picking out assassins or assassinations that changed the world or didn't change the world throughout history, I mean, where do you start and how do you, if you like, whittle it down to those that are the most important? I mean, obviously, everybody can sort of say they knew where they were when JFK was shot, so that's an assassination absolutely. That shook the world.
Now, that certainly shook the world, but did it have a great effect? That, at that time, America was engaged, or getting engaged, in the war in Vietnam. And they were going to assist the South Vietnamese for resisting the invasion from North Vietnam. And it was the major conflict between the Cold War, between Russia and communism, and America and freedom. And in his presidency, Kennedy had already sent 50,000 Americans into Vietnam who were not combative but gave them a great deal of support to try and shore up the government. And he was assassinated in 1963 in Dallas, as everybody knows, and a year later he was very concerned about winning the re-election as president. And in the speech that he was going to make in Dallas, which was never made, he made very clear he was going to support the Vietnamese in whatever was needed. And the argument sometimes is that LBJ got too involved in Vietnam. The argument I put to that is that I think Kennedy would have got just as involved, quite frankly. He was not going to let South Vietnam fall to the communists. It was the symbol of the whole of the Cold War. And I think he'd have got involved just as much as LBJ. So I don't believe, although he was a splendid figure and represented many of the best things in America and had done some good things, I don't think it would have changed the history of the world if he had survived. That comes in most... Take Julius Caesar, very famous for stabbing on the Capitol. And the gang of senators led by Brutus, who stabbed him, wanted him to stop being a ruler. He'd almost been offered to become the king of Rome, almost. He was so powerful because he'd been so successful. And they said, no, we want a form of democracy. We want liberty. And so they killed him. But his death led to a civil war between Mark Antony and Brutus, and then Octavian, Caesar's nephew. Mm. And within 13 years, the war was won by Octavian, and he was then made the Emperor of Rome and was given much greater power than even Julius Caesar had. So actually, Julius Caesar's assassination led to the end of the Republic of Rome and the beginning of the imperial history of Rome.
I mean,
which is exactly what Brutus was trying to stop.
If you look at some, and that's an example that sort of, if you like, goes against what the assassins were trying to take out. If you look at, for example, the death of Marat, which is famously recorded in a painting of him sort of expiring languidly in a bath.
He was stabbed by Charlotte Corday, who came from Brittany, and Gibraltar, and she was against him because he was a Jacobin, and the Jacobins were killing off the moderates called the Girondins, and lots of her friends were Girondins, and they had been guillotined, and she was so angry at this that she decided that he was the main promoter of that, and so she went to Paris by herself, bought a butcher's knife, knocked at the door and said, "Can I see Marat?" And his servant said, "Oh, no, don't come, you can't possibly see him." But she said, "No, I've come to bring you good news." And so they let her in, and she went into the room where he was lying in a bath because he had a skin disease, and she stabbed him. Now, that was a single person working alone. Within a week, she was guillotined. And she didn't stop the terror, because the great terror, where hundreds were guillotined, started after that by Robespierre, who was prepared to eliminate all opposition. So it did not, she hoped to stop the French Revolution, but it didn't, she intensified it. And that's often the case with assassinations.
I mean, when you come
to... That's a famous one, as you say, there's a famous painting of him lying in the bath, dead.
I don't think in reality it was perhaps so prosaic as the painting sort of records. When you come to research and write a book, and it must stay with you for a while, but again, as I said at the beginning of the interview, you know, you were a man who escaped through sheer luck an assassination, and I think of those who lost their lives, and the one that really shook me first was perhaps the assassination of Henri Neve in 79, a very brave man indeed.
I remember that.
Yeah.
I was in the House of Commons when it happened. I was in the Library of the House of Commons, and I heard this explosion, and I thought perhaps it set up a bomb in the chamber, but no. Then I went and looked out the window, and I looked down on the car park, and I saw this car that was halfway up the ramp, completely blown, half blown up. And then someone went down, one of the officials of the house went down to identify it was Henri Neve. And that was a bomb under his car, and it operated when the car was on a slope. It was very clever device, because the RA did devise very clever bombs. And so when he drove from his car, from his flat just round the corner, parked in the House of Commons, it didn't decelerate as it went down, but when he drove it out, it decelerated and it blew the car up. And he was killed almost instantly.
But when you come to research and write a book, it stays with you. So it must be, especially when you're doing the research, so it must be, it's a great historical reference and it's a thought-provoking book, but it's obviously, there must be something personal in there as well.
Yeah, I agree. It does stay with you because I obviously took 100 quite well-known people, including Osama bin Laden. And that was a very deliberate planned attack, as you saw, by the President of the United States and the military of the United States. And they actually watched it all on television. And they watched the plane, the two helicopters landing, one semi-crashed, and they watched the whole invasion of the house in which Osama bin Laden was living, just 80 miles north of Islamabad. And they saw him actually being shot. And they saw his body carried downstairs and put into the helicopter, and all the people got away. It was a remarkable operation, and that could only be done with the huge force of a state and the power of a state. And that was really a revenge killing, if you were, because Osama bin Laden, that the hunt for Osama bin Laden, Barack Obama decided that the hunt for Osama bin Laden had got rather cold, so he was headed up. And that was a quite remarkable achievement. But there is a wonderful pictures in the book of them all watching the actual, all the eight assassins that were watching the television to see what happened.
Talking about revenge killings, there is perhaps no nationality that has a history of revenge and honour killings and family feuds than the Albanians, especially in Europe. I raised a smile about King Zog of Albania, who seems to have been basically assassination proof.
Yes, he had about 35 attacks upon him, and he used to, he got in the habit of firing. When he was going to the opera one night, he fired back at them. But King Zod was the most nearly assassinated. The two things he's remembered for is his name and the fact that he escaped so many assassinations.
What do you hope that the people will take then from your book?
I hope that they'll realise that assassinations achieve very little. They tend to put out good people rather than bad people. Occasionally, a bad person is killed. One of the kills of king and his wife, the king of Bosnia, was killed. He was a very bad egg. And sometimes they're bad eggs, but often they are not. There was an assassination by the early RA in Phoenix Park in Ireland, in Dublin, in the 1870s, when a British politician had been sent over as the Governor General. And then he decided to walk back across the park to his house. And the IRA got knowledge of this, and a group of assassins stabbed him to death. He was a good man. And very often good people are killed. The day of the mad assassin by himself, that could still happen. That could obviously happen. And that's why there's so much security around the Prime Minister today and around the President. Four American presidents have been assassinated. The most famous, obviously, was Abraham Lincoln. But McKinley was killed by a madman, an anarchist, who, when he opened a trade fair, there was an attempt to kill Reagan, and it very nearly worked. He had a shot near his lung. And I imagine that Trump is very, very carefully protected indeed. Mm. Following the Kennedy assassination, politicians no longer parade standing up in cars in big cities that were in their election processes. They're much more carefully protected because there might be anybody in the skyscraper with a rifle trying to take them out. And I'm sure that there have been, that we haven't heard of, probably some assassination attempts on Trump that have not been publicised at all. And he would not publicise them either, because that would just encourage people.
Indeed. The book is called On Assassinations. It's by Lord Baker. And it's out now on Unicorn. I can't let you go, by the way, Lord Baker, because you were Home Secretary, of course, amongst many other things. The papers this morning have obviously, in the weekend, has been full of stories about what's happening over in the UK, and you're in lovely Sussex, I believe. Quite close to the Channel. An interesting time for the current incipients of the Home Secretary's position.
Very tricky indeed, because since the beginning of August, 600 migrants have travelled from France to Britain in little rubber dinghies, arriving at various beaches in Kent. And this is a very difficult thing to stop. Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, wants to stop it, but it's a very difficult thing to stop. You've really got to get the support of French to try and stop the French, to get the French government to stop the boats actually leaving. Because once it moves into British waters, and the line is very clearly defined in the Channel, then we cannot send them back to France. But if the French authorities could operate, and I think that she's going to try and persuade them to do much more, and if necessary, to give them money to do much more, to stop them actually leaving, because they leave. There are various pictures already on television in Britain of groups leaving late at night, when it's really quite dark, and you see the shadowy figures loading these boats almost to capsizing point. Boats that should take 8 have 12 or 14 or so, and it's a miracle that no one is so drowned. Mm. But once they get into British waters, they've got to be conducted safely to Britain. It's a very difficult thing to deal with, and there's talk now of the Navy being involved, but big boats can't do this. It can only be done by a small number, probably larger than small boats.
It's another
way of trying to get into Britain other than trying to get onto a lorry.
Yeah, it's a situation we are familiar with in Spain, obviously, as we've had people crossing the Mediterranean and trying to get to the Canary Islands as well for decades now.
Oh, so you have indeed.
So it's a pleasure.
And you've got those two. Spain has got those two settlements.
Indeed,
in North Africa,
Ceuta and Melilla. Yes,
Medela,
yeah.
Where people from sub-Saharan Africa turn up and try to get in, and then try to get into Spain.
Indeed. But anyway, this book is called On Assassinations. It's by Lord Baker. It's out now on Unicorn. Lord Baker, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Nice talking to you. Have a good day.